Here at Sanctuary Spa, we know how stressful life can be. Rushing around, no time for us. That's why we've developed a new generation of body moisturisation for modern life. Apply Sanctuary Spa Wet Skin Radiance Jelly straight from the shower for daily exfoliation and hydration. With our new 2-in-1 gel, locking in 3 times the moisture, leaving your skin radiant. Make it part of your routine. Just shower, apply and dry. Sanctuary Spa Wet Skin Radiance Jelly. Available now, exclusively at Boots.
You don't remember anything last night, huh?
I got really melodramatic, didn't I?
You told me that you weren't really on a vacation. That you've been looking for a job for a year. And your boyfriend didn't work out.
You are out of control.
What?
I've packed your things. They're in the bedroom.
What?
And since you didn't have any money, you decided to move back here.
Is there anything else?
Don't remember anything.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Slash Filmcast, the official podcast of slashfilm.com. I'm David Chen, and with me is...
Devendra Hardwar.
And joining us today, she's a news writer at slashfilm.com, Huai Chen Bui. Welcome back to the Slash Filmcast. How are you doing today, HT?
I'm good. Thanks for having me again.
Great to have you on. And we should mention that Jeff Cannata was going to join us tonight, but he had some issues with childcare, and we are very understanding and supportive of that. He may join us later on in this episode, so stay tuned to potentially hear Jeff Cannata. But yeah, we're gathered here today to record the Slash Filmcast and actually just do a review of the new Nacho Vigalondo movie, Colossal. We had 3 hours worth of podcasting last week, so this is going to be an abridged episode for this week. We hope you enjoy it anyway. As we talk about this movie that has created a lot of buzz online for a variety of different reasons, it's Nacho Vigalondo, one of our favorite filmmakers, making another movie, and it deals with a lot of themes that are relevant in today's political environment.
Monsters. Deals with monsters.
Monsters. Monsters male, are always male relevant. Entitlement, yeah. Toxicity monsters. Of masculinity, all mm-hmm. that good stuff. So before we begin, I do want to mention that I'm going to read the plot summary from IMDb. We will talk about the basic plot of the film. And I would actually encourage you to check it out if you haven't seen the plot. If you don't know what the plot is, don't mm-hmm. watch the trailer. Go check out the movie and be surprised, because this movie is really surprising. There are a lot of unique aspects to it, and it is possible to go in fresh since it's a small kind of indie film. That being said, we're going to talk about the premise. Here we go. Gloria is an out-of-work party girl forced to leave her life in New York and move back home. When reports surface that a giant creature is destroying Seoul, South Korea, she gradually comes to the realization that she is somehow connected to this phenomenon. The movie stars Anne Hathaway, Jason Sudeikis, Tim Blake Nelson, Dan Stevens, and a bunch of other really talented people. Devendra Hardwar, this is a movie that you really pulled for us to discuss here on the Slash Filmcast. So what was it that really resonated with you about Colossal?
This movie's astounding. Like, that's pretty much it. And it's Nacho Vigalondo doing kind of what he does best, right? Like, taking a genre that we're used to, like with time crimes and like with extraterrestrial, and just like putting a bit of a twist on it, and also a very like emotional and human beat to it as well. And I love that he just keeps doing that. I haven't seen Open Windows, is that weird like multi-screen thing he did a while ago. But I love Time Crimes. Extraterrestrial is very good, probably not as memorable. I just love that this is a great genre movie that really shows that we could do something new. And it's like, it's so good. It's just the story it tells is so well done, so meaningful. And I think so important, too, because you don't quite expect where it's going to go.
Yeah, definitely takes some unexpected turns, in
yeah,
my opinion.
Yeah, so I love all of that. I love being surprised by the story, and that's something that Vigalondo does so well. Great performances all around, too, especially Jason Sudeikis. And, you know, like, I love this movie all around. Like, it's just so well done. I love the emotional beats. My one thing, as I saw this movie and, you know, as I came out of it, it did feel really weird that this movie about, you know, realization of a bunch of, you know, white folks basically involves the, you know, the death of like countless, you know, Asian
people,
faceless yeah. Asians with
faceless
no like,
Asians.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, like they have nothing. Right. Maybe we talk to one person at the end of the movie and even that's not quite something. So I think like that's my only thing. I just wish this imagery wasn't there. If the city that this giant monster was appearing in was like, you know, a more diverse metropolitan city or something, that problem just wouldn't even be there. And I actually don't think that particular setting of Seoul, other than like evoking like, oh, man, like remember other giant monster movies, which right. took place in like, you know, mm-hmm. Asian cities and, you know, you had the screaming crowds and everything. I think that's really the only reason it's there. And if that were changed to, you know, like Paris or something or just a more diverse city, that one little niggle would not be there.
Well, I have more thoughts on that we'll have to get into in spoilers, but HT, why don't you tell us your overall thoughts on Colossal, and then let's dive into spoilers.
Yeah, so I had not seen any Nacho Vigalondo movies before this, so I went in completely unprepared. I was really astounded by how unpredictable this movie was, and that was really refreshing for me, just because even in indie movies or genre movies, you can kind of tell where the plot was going. But for Colossal, I had really no idea, because I went in with the marketing expecting a sort of surrealist comedy almost. Mm-hmm. I think Vigalondo previously described this as being John Malkovich meets Godzilla, which isn't quite accurate. I'd say it's more kind of like the marriage of, you know, your typical indie dramedy with a kaiju movie. Although, like, the kaiju part is kind of inconsequential, like you were saying, Devendra. They just use it to evoke, like, that sort of
symbolism.
Feeling you get of it. Yeah, the symbolism of it. Like, they just use it as the monster, as metaphor. And, like, metaphor for only, you know, white people's struggles, essentially. But, like, they aren't any less important, but, you know, they don't really have anything to do with the kaiju genre. Mm-hmm. But I really liked it. I really liked that whole idea of making toxic masculinity the ultimate villain in this. And it kind of continues the whole trend of the social thriller that we've seen with, like, Get Out, that has been ongoing. And I really like that this was such a surprise and was such so well done in that sense.
Yeah, like, when you say Get Out, like, a genre movie that has pretty clear social commentary, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Well, I think it's really hard to talk about this movie without talking about spoilers. I will just say I enjoyed the movie as well. I agree with a lot of what you guys said. A lot of unexpected turns. I thought it was going to zig, and the movie zagged instead. And I just found it to be pretty delightful overall, and I think it has a lot to say. It also does some things really in a unique fashion, and just shows you just stuff that you're not going to see in any other movie this year. You know, there's a lot that's really refreshing about it. And so, if there's no other thoughts pre-spoilers, I think we can dive into spoilers pretty quickly. I'll just say, yeah, the performances all around are really solid, and I liked the way that the movie built on itself. If that makes sense, there's decisions and events that occur earlier on that then later on, like, it really it's paid off at the end. I'm trying to be as
motivations
as possible.
Are very clear, and I love it when a movie is like emotionally true, especially like when its characters do.
Yeah, everything is earned in this film. Yeah.
Agreed. All right, well, let's get to spoilers for Colossal starting right now.
Now you're looking for the secret.
Can I see this coming?
No.
But you won't find it because, of course,
you're not going to see this coming.
You're not really looking.
I have been puzzling over how it works.
You don't really want to work it out.
Who's in the box?
I have been dying to tell you.
I want to tell you my secret now.
You want to be fooled.
I think one of the great assets of this movie is Jason Sudeikis. And specifically that you believe, at least I believe, that this was going to be a romance story between him and Oscar and Gloria.
Well, the movies that they've kept trying to sell us Jason Sudeikis in, right? Oh, he's that charming, lovable goofball, and you'd love him as your boyfriend, so love him, please?
Yeah, they really leaned into his whole affability. That's a part of his persona.
You know, the movie is unintentionally, I don't know if it's intentional, maybe it's completely intentional, that the Asian people are faceless. You know, that the Asian people,
well, it's those crowds, right?
Are disposable. Yeah, maybe it's completely intentional that like it is a commentary on white people's tendency to completely subsume the individuality of non-white people to white people's needs, right? Like maybe that's a commentary.
I don't know if it was intentional. It felt pretty inconsequential to me. Just kind of it just happened to be that way.
But you understand, like, if it was intentional, I mean, even if it's not intentional, I choose to read the movie that way. I choose to read it as a commentary on how white people are imperiling minority groups for the sake of their own self-actualization.
I think Vigilando talked a little bit about that thing. But what's interesting about him is that I've read a couple interviews, right? And he's not just saying, you know, he's not doing the thing where he's like completely not going to tell you what it's saying. But he's almost saying like what the story is telling is just like a very specific thing, right? Like he almost can't control.
Right. And what do you think that is? What is that specific thing? What is the as Bruce Lee in the chat room asks, what is the thesis of this film?
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I'm asking you, Devendra, like what do you think it is?
I don't think there is a thesis when it comes to
Asian people.
Yeah, I think that is like him evoking monster movies and things he loved as a kid. He did talk a bit about that too, I think. And I that's understandable. I think any director working in a genre thing does it for the love of the genre. I just wish like those bits, you could read it as sort of like, you know, this is the collateral damage of these emotionally insecure white people. And it's just like, you know, this is what happens. People die. I do think the movie does a good job of eventually, once they realize what's happening, like the fact that innocent people are getting hurt becomes a plot point. Mm-hmm. I just wish that occurred before like the first like drunken session where she definitely killed people and she, you know, she feels bad about it. And I think that's key to the character too, because that's kind of, it drives the whole final conflict and everything.
Sorry, go ahead, Devendra.
Yeah, I just don't know if that was necessary. I think it is sort of flippant. It's like, oh, well, these people died. Oh, crap. And they kind of joke about it at first and then not so much.
Again, not saying this was intentional. Mm-hmm. Not even saying this is a correct reading of the movie. It's one of my readings of the movie, which is that you know what I was reminded of when I saw this movie and saw these people just randomly off all these Asian people is the people who – like the Bernie bros, to be honest with you.
Right.
People who said – no, people who were like, well, I'm not getting my way, so I'm just going to throw – I'm not going to vote at all, you know? And it's,
the male side of that for sure, yeah.
Yeah, and it is a distinctly privileged point of view to be able to vote your conscience. Like to be able to say, hey, I'm just going to sit this one out because I'm not getting exactly what I want. Who cares what the impact is for other people?
Right. Or I'll burn it all down.
Right, because I'm not going to be impacted. Right, yeah. I as a white person, sometimes a white male, I'm not going to be impacted. So hey, it doesn't matter who gets elected because it's not going to affect me. That's what that's what came to mind when I watched.
I wonder if this election is coloring your view of this movie.
For sure. I don't think it was intentional, but anyway.
It's definitely an aspect of that, right?
Speaking of white males, Jeff Kanata is back. Jeff,
whenever someone says white male. An angel delivers a white male to the conversation.
Jeff, we're in spoiler section for Colossal.
That didn't
back.
Take long.
Yeah, no, it did, because we didn't want to spoil. Like, there's so many surprises in this movie. You know, we didn't want to spoil too much. But we were just talking about kind of some of the meanings of this movie. Now, putting aside the people who chose to vote third party, the kind of more common interpretation of what's going on is: you guys listen to the S-Town podcast yet? The great S-Town podcast.
I've only listened to the first episode.
I will not spoil anything from the S-Town podcast, but I will say that at one point, you know, it's about people down south. Like the S-Town podcast largely is about the South and about the people there, and that there is this tendency of people down there to have this attitude known as "fuck it," meaning like, oh, who, like, it doesn't matter what the consequences of this action might be. My life is already incredibly bleak anyway, so just fuck it. Let's vote for Donald Trump, or let's jump in this river full of battery acid, or something. You know, whatever action they're going to take, that there is this kind of this mm-hmm. Recklessness that kind of pervades some areas of the South, and that came to mind when I was watching Colossal as well. This idea that Jason Sudeikis' life in this movie, Oscar's life, is not super awesome. And so if he has the opportunity to hurt people, to lord it over people, that he's going to use it, right?
Yeah.
And
I mean, that feels a little different, but because he's not desperate. Yeah,
I feel like those aspects are somewhat part of the movie, mm-hmm. like his situation and his sort of, you know, being stuck in a small town. But I feel like that takes a backseat to the whole metaphor of his toxic masculinity mm-hmm. and like fragile male ego.
It's insecurity. Like sure. that's what it is. It's lashing out because he's not good enough. And then here's this girl that he's pined for, you know, his entire life, who it turns out it's not that he had a crush on her, because that seems like part of it, but also he envied her in a weird way and sort of like latched onto her. So I think that all kind of comes together. So I don't think it's as simple as like just the fuck it mentality. It's more like this, like, oh man, I've hated this person for so long. And it's like, it's just like a slow boiling simmer of insecurity and how that unleashes. That's what it feels like more for me. And that all ties directly into, you know, the whole idea of like what this movie is actually about, like very specifically about toxic masculinity and everything. I just like that one bit about I just wish like we didn't have to deal with the, you know, the crowds of faceless Asian people getting killed for that. And one thing too, the monster keeps reappearing in the same exact spot. Fucking close down that part of the city. Why should people there? Why should just hang out?
I know, they didn't evacuate anyone. They just kept going about their lives, and like they always are surprised that the monster appears. Like, oh my god, how could we know?
Same time, same place. Quarantine that area, guys. That's like one. I don't know what was going on.
It's monster movie 101. Quarantine that area. Jeff Cannata, what are your overall thoughts on the movie? And you said you had some specific things you wanted to share with us too, right? So do you like Colossal?
It's difficult. I'm coming into the middle of this conversation, so I don't know what has been said or hasn't been said. But I thought the science fiction concepts in Colossal were just wonderful, and I, you know, I always advocate on the show for clear rules, and I think in science fiction the story often benefits from understandable, very clear rules. They don't have to actually make any sense. Like we don't need a reason for everything. We just need to know what the thing is. And I think this movie does that really, really well and proves that point. Like we don't have to, I mean, we do kind of get an origin for why this happened, but even the origin is like, oh, lightning hit the thing. So yeah, it works. And that's fine. That's enough. We just need to know like, okay, at this specific time, this why, and only these two people, and here's where it has to happen. All of that stuff, I thought beautifully expressed, and a really awesome sci-fi idea. And I also wonder if this was the inspiration of this was a little bit of like walking into a mocap studio and going, huh, I wonder if that in like yeah. real, what would that be like? Anyway, I hear you guys talking about the toxic masculinity and stuff. And sadly, I guess as the white male, I'm embarrassed to say this, but I didn't find anything that Jason Sudeikis' character did to be believable. I thought he ruined the movie. That character, not his performance, he was fine, but mm-hmm. the character, I was not along for any of that. I loved her story and like her sort of where she was in her life and her struggles and all and finding real meaning through this crazy set of circumstances she finds herself in and this weird power that she gets. But I didn't find his turn to be motivated. I didn't find the setup for how he ends up behaving to be sufficient. I guess we're supposed to believe it all came down to that one poetic moment when he, you know, he smashed her thing because he was jealous of her, and then forever. I never bought it. Right, I never bought any of it. Well,
what I love is that there are a lot of breadcrumbs throughout this movie, right? Like I think by the end, you realize him coming every day being like, oh, yeah, you asked for this thing, right? Like, oh, I'm just helping out. You need a couch. You need a TV. I'm a nice guy. By the end of the movie, you realize he's gaslighting her. Like, yeah. The movie has these breadcrumbs all throughout where it's like he definitely is infatuated with her in a weird way. And you think it's love, and I think that one bit early on, I don't think it all comes down to him, like, crushing her thing, but that does reveal, like, an inherent jealousy of what's going on. So, yeah, the turn really happens once he discovers his power, right? Like, yeah. This insecure guy who didn't have anything, and now he has something, and now it's abused immediately.
Yeah, I agree with Devendra. I think there are a lot of red flags that pop up throughout the movie, and a lot of it is informed by our idea of the nice guy, TM, I guess you would say. So it's like the idea of his obsession with her and his fixation with her, and that becoming malicious. Like at the beginning when he's giving her furniture, he gives her a TV and a futon out of the kindness of his heart. But in the end, after the reveal of his robot form, he gives her this whole truck full of antiques from his grandma's house. And that becomes a sort of malicious, like almost in a blackmail threatening kind of way. Like, if you don't accept these things, something bad will happen.
And she didn't want it, right? Too.
Yeah, she didn't want it. That was the point where she was like, I don't think that whatever you give me, I won't give you anything in return. If that makes sense. Like
the scene though, when he sets off the fireworks in the bar.
Oh man.
That was a really scene.
It felt like a scene that works really good on a page and is this amazing piece of writing of like this speech that he gives and the metaphor he uses and the setup of like, what's the most, I don't remember what the word he uses, the most,
Yeah, the most dangerous thing.
Dangerous? Do. Was it dangerous? Something. So anyway.
Dangerous thing that happened in this bar, yes. Or something, yes. Like that.
Yeah. And then they're standing around and the thing is just there's fire everywhere and he's completely calm and in control. I didn't buy it for a second. We turned into a cartoon.
Well, what didn't you buy about it, Jeff? That he would do something so destructive?
Or? That he would do it. The way he does it. The purpose of doing it, like what does he do? And the sort of weird confidence that he has that she's not going to leave or.
Yeah.
This goes towards my point of like, fuck it. You know, that there is this kind of recklessness of there.
It's
of
much
like,
more than fuck it.
Yeah, though. No, I agree. Yeah. I agree with your guys' points. I'm just saying that there's a strain of that I think runs through the entire film. But I'm sorry, HT, what were you going to say?
See, that escalation works for me because that scene especially feels really reminiscent of abusive relationships, especially mm-hmm. like relationships in which the woman feels like she cannot escape or she cannot leave this relationship because she is dependent on this other person. And in a way, like Anne Hathaway's character is, because, you know, if she stays with him, then he won't, you know, kill countless people in Seoul, Korea. He gets what he wants in getting to control her. So I think that like that part was, again, another manifestation of mm-hmm. this sort of this problem that we see every day in our ordinary lives of domestic abuse and of abusive relationships.
Yeah, it's really all about control, right? Like that scene. So reconstruct that scene, right? What happens? She brings in Dan Stevens, another nice guy in a very different way. We should also at some point talk about how every man in this movie fails her.
They're terrible.
Every man. Like, even if they're trying to do good and even if they're like she fucked up and just did shit, like every dude, even good-looking young jock dude, fails her. So that scene, right, reconstructing it, she brings Dan Stevens in and then it becomes a dick measuring contest. That's what it immediately becomes, right? Like that whole awkward conversation, him not getting the coffee for the customer, and shit just escalates, right? And I think it is partially fuck it that, yeah, I'll just burn all this down because, you know, what does the bar matter? He's a fucking giant robot now, you know, like he's got more going on. But yeah, he burns it all down. And then also shows like how crazy he can be, right? This is how insane he is. He still gets the girl. And that's kind of what he's trying to prove to Dan Stevens. That scene I love just because it's so goddamn unpredictable. We had no clue what was going to happen. Yeah.
Right, because it's not grounded in any kind of reality from my perspective. And yeah. And I would so be on board with the idea of it being a abusive relationship. I was ready for that to sort of be the central metaphor, and maybe it is that it just didn't land on me in the right way. I didn't buy that explanation for that character's behavior, because I would understand if it was the Dan Stevens character, because she has this whole back history and she keeps calling him in her times of need. Like, that's the abusive relationship that I sort of get. That's weird. This is just some dude. Like, he gives her a job that is – who cares? Like, I don't understand.
Childhood friend, and there is some connection. Like, they know each other, right? He's not just some rando. There's somebody with, like, history, and that's all.
I don't understand. Like, the – I guess the idea of him being able to kill a bunch of people in Korea is a thing, but it was such an abstract way to rope her into that behavior. I just didn't ever buy that he was that thing to her.
Mm-hmm. Wait, let me ask
was,
you,
he
Jeff.
Was what thing, Jeff?
The abusive boyfriend, the I can't quit you, the guy that you know is wrong, but there's something that – there's some power he has over her. I never got that he had power over her, and I never understood why she allowed right. him to so have reign over her.
The metaphor for his power over her being the what the future victims of whatever rampage he makes if she leaves, that didn't ring true for you, essentially.
I just thought that came so late in the process.
It was before. It was before the bar scene.
Like, that right, dynamic had already been established, you're saying.
Yes, yes, yeah. yes.
It felt to me like, I don't know. I mean, well,
do you guys see this video essay that debuted recently called Born Sexy Yesterday? Do you guys see this?
Yeah.
It's a video essay that I thought was actually really, really well done. And I'd recommend anyone check it out. I'll link to it in the show notes. But it's essentially covers the trope. It shows you all the examples of in the past of how there's all these movies mm-hmm. where there are women who are very sexualized but who have the minds of children. Right, like literally children, or people who behave as children. Think of Lilu from Fifth Element, Olivia Wilde's character in Tron Legacy, and countless other examples that mm-hmm. are that the Pop Culture Detective, that's a YouTube channel, covers in this Born Sexy Yesterday trope. And the conclusion he draws is that the Born Sexy Yesterday trope is about. Here, I'm going to just read from the essay. The subtext of the trope is rooted in a deep-seated insecurity about sex and sexuality. The crux of the trope is a fixation on male superiority, a fixation withholding power over an innocent girl. But in order to make it socially acceptable, science fiction is employed to put the mind of that girl into a sexualized adult woman's body. End mm-hmm. quote. So it's basically about like men want to control women. They are threatened by women who are sexually experienced, who are very intelligent. And so there's this fantasy. Men have this fantasy that, there's like I can be in control of this person who doesn't know any better, like is not familiar with the ways of the world and who will regard me as incredibly intelligent and powerful.
Yeah, and that –
And so this is a trope that's existed over decades, mm-hmm. and I just felt like Colossal took this trope and kind of flipped it, right? It's that here's – it's not that the girl is – younger or more inexperienced or more naive, it's that the guy now has all this power that he didn't have before. And what would happen if that occurred?
And
right?
he's really naive in his own way too. But yeah, that trope is actually important too, because we see her experience, right? We see her independence. Like once she has sex with the young dude and Oscar sees that, then there's that whole other awkward bar scene, right? And that was before the Dan Stevens scene. Yeah, so this is how it leads up, Jeff, right? So then he's like, oh, she slept with him. Well, man, I wanted to do that. I'm going to fucking just like put my foot down and like, ruin my friendship with the Tim Blake Nelson character, which how heartbreaking was that? Like just like the little things you see him doing too, like you assume that guy is up to something. you know, when he's going to the bathroom or doing stuff. So it's like a little, it's almost like a little Edgar Wright little tidbit in there. If you really go back and look at the movie, you could see him doing stuff. But the way Oscar calls that out, just like lording, like everything he can be to be superior around everyone around him, that's what he starts doing immediately. Yeah. He drives away Oscar, and like, yeah, it's all part of it.
Basically, Jeff, men are terrible. And this movie seems to...
Not going
to
argue with that.
Right. And I guess, I don't know, like, given that, the Jason Sudeikis character, it surprised me. I did not anticipate that's where the story would go, but it did not feel unbelievable to me, right? Mm. Which I think is where you're saying it was not plausible to you. It was totally plausible to me because it plays into a lot of dynamics that powerless men have with women. But it did not... It was not implausible to me that it would have happened that way.
And we never see them actually kiss, right? The Jason Sudeikis character. Like, he's just – he's always pining. He's always pining. Want to do something. He just never does it, and he's gaslighting. Meanwhile, you know, the handsome young dude, like, does the thing he wants, and he gets pissed off about that. There's a lot of, like, inadequacy going on there too. But another interesting – like, Jeff, what do you think of Jason Sudeikis as an actor and as, like, a romantic comedy guy?
Oh, I really like him. I think he's I think he's an affable.
There you go.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're used to seeing him as, like, you know, affable, likable guy. Every time I see him, I'm like, that dude is up to something. Like, there is some smarminess. There's something going on. I just can't trust it. And I think this is the first movie I've seen with him in it that really veers into that territory. Like, there is almost like a darkness to him, and that's true of a lot of comics. You know, Michael Keaton has that. Bill Murray has that too. But this movie veers into it in a really – that's kind of what made it feel believable to me too. Like, that – the nice guyness turning into complete smarminess and that evolving into total evil, that felt – I don't know. And he played it so well too. He's like a natural at it.
You know what this movie also reminds me of, or makes me think of? A lot of those male wish fulfillment rom-coms, like quirky rom-coms like Garden State, 500 Days of Summer, Ruby Sparks, and this Colossal feels like a commentary on those kind of films and how those women are made out to be incredibly flat and incredible, again, wish fulfillment for the male protagonists who are often incredibly ordinary. And this feels like it's taking that and turning it on its head by making Anne Hathaway's character so complicated and by making Jason Sudeikis' character, who we traditionally see as the charming, likable male lead, into the villain.
Right. It's like, what would happen if the manic pixie dream girl rejected you? Right. Like, this is kind of a sort of logical extreme of that idea, I think.
And they're monsters.
Right. Yeah, right. And they're monsters. Yeah.
And another lens of that, by the way, is like I think he sees her as the manic pixie dream girl too, right?
Right.
He sees himself as the lead in one of those movies.
Correct.
Whereas we see her as the flawed, you know, human she is, and she's just trying to live her life. But you see of like, yeah, what the expectations of one of those movies is. So you can see it both ways. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah. I do want to shout out one random thing about the movie that I really enjoyed, which is that this is one of the few movies I've seen where a character will get blackout drunk and then later on, you know, another character will refer to things that character said or did, but you never saw them yourself as the viewer.
Right.
Right. I just thought that was a really clever and disorienting way to show the state of her drunkenness, is that all this stuff is happening that she didn't even know about while she was blackout drunk.
And also how easy it is for him to gaslight her too, right? Because not all that is true.
Yeah.
Like, he's just like, you accept it's true, but kind of just making that up. But speaking, there is a point I want to make about all the dudes, right? I just found that to be a fascinating way to view this film, right? Dan Stevens' character, he is understandably, like, mad at her for, like, what, not having a job and kind of just, like, partying and, like, maybe wasting her life a little or something. So he's putting that judgment on her. And I think there's maybe some sort of, like, you know, they've had a long relationship, so there's probably some sort of codependency there, too, where they're both kind of assholes sometimes, but it also seems like a relationship where they've kind of learned to live with that. But I found it interesting that, you know, he tries to trick her into coming with him later on. And the young dude, that scene, guys, the scene in the playground where it goes from pushing to Oscar, like, assaulting her was so hard to watch. And the young guy is just like, he's not doing anything. He's just standing there. And I'm like, oh, that is also every guy who's like, just doesn't step in when she gets too real.
Yeah.
It frustrated me more, actually, when they were at the bar and Jason Sudeikis' character, I can't remember their names, was threatening to go to the playground to go on a rampage. And Anne Hathaway was trying to stop them. And the young guy just gets in the car with Jason Sudeikis and they just drive off together. He's completely enabling him, but he doesn't even try to stop. Yeah, he doesn't even try to stop him.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I think it's about how most people are weak, and weakness is often just conformity, going along with the flow, indifference to the suffering of others, right? Is one form of weakness that I think this movie is highlighting in a really effective way. So, cool. Well, I have to say, unfortunately, Jeff Cannata has had to go again due to childcare reasons, but we really appreciated him joining us for a little bit. Do we have any other closing thoughts on this?
I'm Piers Linney. Join me for Rethinking Business, a new podcast series brought to you by NatWest. Let's face it, the path to business success is rarely straightforward. That's why in this series, we're hearing from businesses who are thinking differently. My guest this week is Freddie Garland, founder of Freddie's Flowers.
I think having someone who is able to advise you is critical. It's essential to have a good sounding board for when you've got a question.
That's Rethinking Business by NatWest. Subscribe now.
This movie, I think there's a lot to digest, a lot to analyze.
What do you guys think about the final climactic decision, right? That whole plan. Were you surprised by her decision to actually go to Seoul and basically taking on faith that whatever voodoo was happening would happen backwards?
I mean, I would have preferred a little bit more explanation, maybe 10% more explanation of how the mechanics of this world work. It's fine. In a movie where you believe that no one has ever stepped foot in this playground at this specific time of day in the last few decades, and that it transforms you into a monster across the other side of the world if you do step into it. If you're willing to buy that stuff, then I feel like the idea that it's the opposite of that when you go to Seoul is not too far out of the realm of possibility. Mm-hmm. We talk frequently about how much movies should give away, how much they should reveal, how much plot, how clear should they be about the rules. I think I could have used a little bit more rules, but not that much. It didn't quite strike the right balance for me, but overall I'd say it worked. How about you, HT?
Yeah, I felt like there were some parts. It was a flawed movie. Especially the parts with the kaiju elements and that not being completely integrated into the story. But I really liked its commentary and it being sort of a social commentary thriller and its whole metaphor of the toxic masculinity. So I really enjoyed it overall. And it was just so refreshing and unpredictable.
And the ending worked for you? Like her going there, you just thought, did you know what was happening when she was doing it?
I sort of guessed it, but I mean, it was a heightened reality anyway.
Yeah.
So I guess I just kind of went along for the ride. They needed to wrap it up somehow.
Something had to happen. I like slow realization though. At first we didn't quite know what she was doing, and the slow realization was like, oh, it's gonna go backwards. It's gonna work the other way, guys. It's so cool.
One of my favorite aspects of the movie is how Jason Sudeikis' character Oscar acts in that scene, which is he's a coward, right? Mm-hmm. He's revealed for who he truly is. And so, again, I know Jeff's not here to rebut me, but that character just felt really consistent to me throughout the whole movie, right? I did not feel that he took a different turn that was unbelievable or anything like that. So, anyway, so those are our thoughts on Colossal, I guess. We really enjoyed it. We suggest you watch it if you have a chance.
And watch his other movies.
Time Crimes.
I will check them out.
Time Crimes is where you want to start, HT.
Yeah.
Okay.
Time Crimes. It's so good. And then he was like, wasn't he like teasing on Twitter? He was like, what about a Time Crimes 2, guys?
Yeah, he said on Twitter that he's going to make a spiritual successor to Time Crimes.
I love this man.
Time Crimes is one of my favorite science fiction movies of all time. So I'm a big fan of that movie and glad to see he is dramatically expanding his scope. And the kind of movie that he's trying to make and still taking genre films and tweaking them a little, make them more interesting, for sure. Give us something we haven't seen before. So
I'm glad to see that he's kind of recovered from Open Windows, which wasn't really well received. That was the Sasha Gray and Elijah Wood movie. I actually haven't seen that based on like how like the reviews just weren't so
good.
It is
on Netflix. It is on Netflix, I believe. Yeah. So if you want to check it out there, yeah.
I'll probably check that out. But Extraterrestrial is also good. That's like his spin on an alien invasion movie. And of course, it's about a relationship. And he does this so well.
You can find more episodes of this podcast at slashfilmcast.com. Email us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. Next week, what are we going to be doing next week, Devendra? I'm pretty sure – well, actually, we'll tell you at the end of this episode. In the meantime, HT, where can we find more of your work on the internet this week?
So you can find me at slashfilm.com, and you can find me on Twitter at htranbuie. And I also run my podcast, Millennial Falcon Podcast, which you can also find us on Twitter at Falcon Podcast. And we are on SoundCloud, Google Play, and iTunes podcast as well.
All right. Devendra Hardware, how about you?
Oh, you can find me on Twitter at Devendra, and I write about tech and gadget.com.
Find all my stuff at davechen.net. Thanks for listening to this week's episode of the Slash Filmcast, the official podcast of slashfilm.com. Next week, King Arthur, right? King Arthur.
Sure. Going to be talking about I am very excited about that.
I am shocked that you're excited for this.
It looks so dumb. It looks
does look very, very silly. King Arthur is what we'll be reviewing next week, and I am looking forward to talking about it with you guys because it's going to make for an interesting review. I anticipate it's going to be an interesting review no matter what, because that is a movie that looks interesting. It doesn't look good.
It looks like Gods of Egypt interesting. You know?
It doesn't look boring.
It looks like Gods of Egypt, but set in the Middle Ages. Right.
Yeah. Also with racist names, but we'll get to that.
Racist names and more on the next episode of the Slash Filmcast. All right, everyone. Welcome to the Slash Filmcast After Dark. The after show for the Slash Filmcast, where we talk about a variety of random topics that may or may not have any importance to anyone, and probably don't, just probably completely inconsequential.
But we know listeners love it, so we don't hate this. Yeah,
we don't hate it. we are at best ambivalent about it. But Devendra Hardwar, you wanted to talk about Lost City of Z, right?
Sure. Yeah. I really enjoyed it, and I remember. I think you were kind of lukewarm on it, right?
Yeah, I was lukewarm on it, and then that lukewarm has since turned into active dislike.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. Okay.
Not a fan. Not a fan.
Yeah, I saw it this weekend, and it's I found it to be kind of fascinating, but also James Gray, I think, is like what's his face, the Midnight Special director. He makes these quiet little movies, right? He makes. This is a big movie for him, like given where the last few things he's done. He did The Immigrant, which was fantastic. Two Lovers, which is also very good. We Own the Night, which is a really good looking movie. That's, it's all right. But Two Lovers and The Immigrant, I think, are some of the best American independent films that we've gotten over the past few years.
Jeff Nichols, by the way, I think is who you're referring
to. Yes, Jeff Nichols.
Midnight Special and Loving. He's the guy that directed those.
Yeah. So I love these types of independent directors who can tell stories in kind of unconventional ways, usually with very few characters. This movie just felt like – it felt so old school. It felt like an old like 1950s or 1960s like adventure film. It's about the search for this city, which may or may not exist in the Amazon. But it's also about like that – drive, like what would drive somebody to do that, and the cost that would have on someone's family, like the time span that this movie covers, kind of astounded me. And there are just points too where it feels like a pure adventure, but it also doesn't feel like it's pro-colonialist garbage. I think it does a balance of like saying like, oh, these people are out there mapping these worlds and everything, but by the way, the natives have, they have something to contribute to our understanding of humanity as well. So I thought it did all that really well. And there are points, too, like it has a great, nice, like quiet score. But there are times where either the score or I don't know if it's like a separate music selection where it just kind of swells up into this like the classic adventure film sounding thing that. Yeah, it just really worked for me. So I really like this movie, Dave.
Yeah, you know, you were talking about what the movie's about. It's about this obsession with, you know, gunning to this lost city. I wish it was about that. You know, I didn't, to be honest, I didn't know what the movie was about. It introduced a lot of really intriguing ideas. Mm-hmm. For instance, Sienna Miller's character, who just ends up being like most of the other characters. She's doing the... they're early 20th century, right? She's doing the early 20th century equivalent of being concerned wife on other end of phone, right?
Yes. Sure.
So instead of being on the other end of phone, she's writing letters and stuff. And there's kind of an interesting element of her being an early feminist, and maybe that's going to lead somewhere. Nope.
That was interesting. Like,
it was not interesting. It went absolutely nowhere whatsoever. Like, it introduces a lot of these interesting threads that just don't go anywhere at all. And
aspect of her character, right? Like, early on, almost immediately, like as soon as we see her, like, we know she's not kind of typical. She's not somebody who's trying to conform to all these roles. And the fact that, like, to me, like, the way to, yeah, I'm not gonna spoil this movie, yeah, but she does things towards the end which I think would be heartbreaking for any mother and any wife to do. But
that,
she does
that, in my opinion, are totally unearned. Like, the movie has done nothing to build up to that. And
yeah, it's also, I mean, this is based on a true story too, right? Like, I wonder how much they were confined by, you know, what actually happened and everything.
I don't think they were confined that much. And just because, you know, I've read articles about how this movie deviates dramatically from even what was in the book, let alone, right, which, right, by the way, the book deviates significantly from what was in real life. I just feel like the movie ended up succumbing to that dreaded disease, biopic syndrome, which is it wanted to just check off a bunch of events that happened without a lot of the connective tissue that would join those events together and make them mean something.
Mm-hmm.
There were some good elements about it. Mm-hmm. You know, I like Charlie Hunnam. I thought the movie
looked
amazing. It just you are convinced that they are in the jungle.
Yep. And Robert Pattinson, like, I love the Charlie Hunnam Robert Pattinson combination. I don't think I would ever have thought that. Like, seeing them in sort of like a really rugged adventure movie and actually believing that they were out there doing the stuff, and yeah, they were doing some. It was a pretty crazy shoot, apparently. But to what you were saying, Dave, like, I do think the movie does set its. The idea is pretty clear early on, right? Like, Charlie Hunnam's character is this guy who, because of something his father did, like, his family standing is not very good. And his entire goal is to, like, I got to get some medals. I got to, like, get some prestige from my family. I'm going to go find this lost city because this could lead to something. And somewhere in the midst of that, so it's the obsession to attain status as well. As well as to, like, that's kind of what leads him in the first journey. And then later on, like, it's a combination of that and, like, this, there is something really new here and we should really pay attention to it. I wish the movie did a better job of conveying that, like, fascination of, like, kind of what makes him so obsessed with the city itself. But I don't know. I just found it.
Yeah, like Zodiac is a movie about obsession. You know, this movie, to me, didn't focus enough on any specific area to be about anything. It could have been about the relationship between fathers and sons, about this husband and his wife, about this guy's obsession. It introduces all these interesting threads, never really does anything with them. So it felt like a lot of unfulfilled potential. I'm not saying
the obsession thread goes all the way through, though.
The what? The obsession? Yeah, that's true. That's true. You're right about that. You're right.
And then it's almost contagious. Then it carries over to the next generation.
Yeah, fair enough.
And almost like how the sins of his father, right, or the mistakes of his father carried over onto him. It definitely sketches, right? Zodiac is a very long movie and it had the time to really linger and it has a lot of characters. This movie has very few characters and it, you know, we're either in the forest, and then we get to like a place I actually didn't think the movie would go at some point, but it's either, you know, we're at home with them or in the forest. I could see what you're saying. It does set up a lot for me though. That one aspect of like what this obsession could lead to. And I actually don't know the conclusion of the actual story, if it ended in the same way or not. But it felt like a fitting ending. It felt like a very James Gray ending. You should check out his other films, Dave, because I think you would actually like them too.
I believe that I would be a fan. He makes the kind of movies that we complain about that don't get made anymore.
Exactly. You know? And this movie, it's it just feels also like a movie that shouldn't exist today. It feels like a movie from the 50s or the 60s.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
For better or worse. But yeah.
So I want to support James Gray. I like the idea of James Gray. I just wasn't a huge fan of this movie, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. I thought Vulture did an interesting interview with James Gray in April. The title of the article is James Gray and the Struggle of the Middle Class Filmmaker. And
yeah,
he's part of a class of filmmaker here. Quote, people assume because I'm a director, I make tons of money. I am struggling financially. I'm very lucky I get to do what it is I want to do. I've made good or bad, very uncompromising movies. The movies exactly that I wanted to make. And that is a beautiful gift, so I'm not complaining about that. But I struggle. I have a hard time paying my bills. I am 47 years old. I live in an apartment. I can't buy a house. If I were coming of age in 1973, I would be in Bel Air. The whole reason for this is exactly what we were talking about, where the middle is gone. Now you have franchises, and you have I made a movie on my iPhone. This is the economic system in a nutshell. Five directors make Marvel, and then there's the rest of us who are trying to scrounge around to find the money to make films, and it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. If the audience only gets to see Marvel, then they only want Marvel. And if they only want Marvel, only Marvel is made. I don't even have a problem with Marvel. The problem is not the specifics of each movie. The problem is it's the only movie you can see now in a multiplex, and when it's the only game in town, you're looking at the beginning of the death throes of an art form. End quote. So quotes like that, Devendra, make me really want to support Lost City of Z,
yeah.
You know, but I just yeah. wasn't a huge fan of the movie.
You are a disappointment, Dave.
I am. Yeah, I disappoint everyone.
Very much so.
Yeah, for sure.
But
for sure.
Check out like his other movies. The Immigrant, I think, is a great – he tells such great small stories about America. Mm. So it's also interesting that this one, yeah, is actually more of a, you know, more of a British story.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Devendra, anything else you've been up to these days? Like, what's going on over there in New York City?
A bunch of stuff.
How's it like? You're still living in Brooklyn, right?
I am still in Brooklyn. I did just go through the Tribeca Film Festival.
Yeah, how was that?
And I did not get to see any movies.
Oh, because yeah, you were covering and doing interviews with people, right?
Yeah. Well, I was spending all my time in the like VR stuff, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of VR stuff. So yeah, check out that coverage on Engadget. But
highlights of the festival.
Yeah, highlights. There is really good VR now, right? We've seen people kind of playing around with it for the past couple of years, but I went through this one thing called The Last Goodbye, which is about a Holocaust survivor who goes back to the former concentration camp where he was sent and where his entire family was killed, right? And you're going back and you're walking through this with him in 360-degree video, and they did this thing where they like painstakingly recreated like several rooms of the concentration camp and like one of the trains that they used to send families there. And that is a strange experience that, you know, other than actually going and visiting these places, it really transports you there. And man, like when people seem to be forgetting about what the Holocaust was and everything that happened, like it is a stark reminder. Like there are points where you see the ovens where they, you know, disposed of bodies. You see, there is one shot of just like a pile of shoes, thousands of shoes, and you think of what happened there. So yeah, seeing those things in VR, and they did this thing where you can actually make eye contact with him as well, because it's stereoscopic, and they did this just the way they captured him. It wasn't like a flat 2D plane. They got him like almost in like a hologram form, but you can make eye contact with this character. We've come a long way in VR, right? This is a really important story, and you know, this is, he had to tell it. It's not like something somebody could tell for him. So yeah,
how do people access this at this point? Like, is it possible for them to, like, do they need to,
yeah,
you need to get a PC, get an Oculus, right?
Like, I think eventually they may release it to Oculus, but actually what they built is this weird, it's almost like a museum like experience. So right.
so you cannot do it if you're at home. Basically.
You can't do it at home.
You need to go to like a traveling thing that has it.
Right? It may be set up at a museum or something eventually, but like the way thing I went through, like there was a docent who helped me through it, and I took off my shoes and I just entered this space that was like a sacred space almost to experience this thing. It felt, you know, just felt very, very meaningful and very emotional. So yeah, it's not something that you could easily translate to your home, but I'm sure just sitting through this thing at home, if you could, would still affect you as much. But yeah, I just like seeing that this, you know, medium is being used in good ways. I don't know if it's ever going to be something everyone will have in their homes, but for things like this, it's definitely like you can't get this by just watching a movie, you know?
Have you heard of this thing called The Void, Devendra?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I did that. Or I did part of that. So did I talk about the Ghostbusters thing?
Yeah. So, okay.
Yeah,
so
that's the void.
I recently drove to Las Vegas to go see Hans Zimmer. On the way there, we stopped in Salt Lake City. And I think Slash from Castle Center Danish tweeted at me. He said, hey, make sure you check out The Void, because The Void is only in like three locations in the world, and one of them is Salt Lake City. And I looked it up, and The Void is essentially a VR experience, but there are objects all around you, like door frames and walls and guns and all this stuff that are mapped into the VR world. So you basically, in your real life, you reach and pick up a gun, and in the VR world, when you reach out and pick up, you're also picking up a gun. Yeah. You feel the gun in your hand, and you can shoot the gun, and you see it do crazy stuff in the VR world, right?
And you're wireless, right? You were wearing the backpack.
Well, I didn't actually do it, but that's what it is, and I was very intrigued by it. We just ultimately didn't have time, but I always thought to myself, huh, I wonder what the Void would have been like.
Yeah. Sounds like you tried it out, right? Well, so the Void's technology powers the Ghostbusters VR thing at Madame Tussauds in New York. And it's pretty cool. You put it on a backpack. You do get a big proton gun. What is cool is that you're actually walking between rooms wearing a completely wireless VR headset, or at least the computer's on your back, which works because you feel like a Ghostbuster with the nuclear reactors on your back as well. But the fact that I could like move from room to room, while still being tracked, and also there were other people with me, so they were like other characters in this Ghostbusters thing, and we were all like experiencing these weird virtual characters kind of attacking us and stuff at the same time. It was all pretty cool. Like, they've definitely gone a long way. It was kind of low res and a little clunky, but I do think like that sort of like shared VR that could track just about everything, that's going to be a huge thing for sure.
Yeah, it seems very immersive, right? Mm-hmm. In a way that you can't get with any other medium. Speaking of immersive, at the Regal Meridian Theater in downtown Seattle, they are opening up 4DX, Devendra Hardwar.
Okay.
4DX. I think if you Google 4DX review,
yes,
I'm pretty sure your review is one of the first ones. It's not on the first page of results, but it's on the second page. Did you do Batman v Superman? Is that right?
I did do Batman.
Yeah, Batman v Superman in 4DX made watching a bad movie worse. That's on the second page of results. So congrats, Devendra. You got your wish. But 4DX, apparently a terrible idea, even though they spent probably a lot of money to bring it to Seattle.
Yeah. I don't care.
Have you had anything like 4DX since the 4DX experience? Like movie enhancement technology that you actually were excited by other than VR?
Those Dolby theaters, have you been to one of those?
No,
Dolby
I don't know what this theaters? Is. So like what is this Dolby theater? Like what is?
So we have one in at the Times Square AMC, but the Dolby Vision theater is basically crazy. It's like laser projection, really, really bright screens. But also it's the only theater right now that does HDR, which is the whole high dynamic range thing that you're getting in newer 4K TVs. And that, like, I was really skeptical of all this stuff for a while. 4K, like, you really will not notice the difference between a 1080p and a 4K stream on a normal TV. But on, a big movie theater, having more resolution is good. But HDR is the big thing, right? Like, just the depth of it, seeing, like, deeper shades of black in certain scenes. Like, I usually show off an episode of Daredevil when people come over just to like tell them about this technology, and just like the way it lights certain things and the way better black levels and the overall contrast of it looks amazing. And having that in a theater, where I think we've lost a lot of brightness too because so many movies have pushed to 3D, just going to theater, seeing a huge bright image like that, it's pretty good. I don't know if they have any in Seattle yet.
I don't think so, but I will look it up. Dolby Cinema, basically, is what
Dolby Vision, yeah.
Dolby Vision, yeah. Very cool, very cool.
Dolby Cinema is the official name, yeah, using Dolby Vision. Yeah.
Sometimes it makes me wish I lived in New York City, but Seattle is also pretty freaking amazing movie town. You know, a lot of we have the biggest film festival in the country, for instance. So, in terms of number of movies and in terms of attendance, I believe. So, So yeah, really, really excited about this year's Seattle International Film Festival. Bummer you didn't get to see any Tribeca. Was there anything coming out of Tribeca that there was a lot of buzz? You know, was there anything?
Not really. The Circle had its big premiere there, but that was the night before.
Oh, tell us about The Circle, Devendra. Tell us about The Circle. This is the new Tom Hanks movie based on the book by David Eggers, right?
Yeah, it's real bad. It's real bad. There's very little good I can say about this movie. I started reading the book too, and the book is just, it has its moments, but it does feel like a really superficial take on, like, you know, the end times via social media or something. And the book kind of annoys me too, because David Eggers talked about how little research he did, right? He's talking about, like, he's such a smart guy. He's figuring this all out on his own. Like, he doesn't need to know what's actually happening. But the movie is just like, it feels like it was ripped out of James Ponsoldt's hands and, like, edited with a hacksaw. Like, there's no motivation for anything. We're introduced to Emma Watson's character, and almost immediately she's thrust into the circle. We don't really get a sense of her life before.
Well,
we see her.
Hold on. You know? So this movie has 17% Rotten Tomatoes. I'm going to read the Wikipedia premise of this movie. May Holland is an ordinary and unaccomplished young woman with an ill father and a mother with a cloying voice. Interesting detail. What? Through an influential college friend, she gets a customer relations job at a powerful internet corporation, The Circle, co-founded by Eamon Bailey and Tom Stenton. She quickly rises up the company ranks and is selected for a plum assignment with The Circle's newest technology, which she eagerly takes on. Soon, she finds herself in a perilous situation concerning privacy, surveillance, and freedom. May comes to learn her decisions and actions will determine the future of humanity. You want to drop some spoilers for The Circle, Devendra? I mean, I don't care.
Sure.
I'm not going to see this movie.
Yeah, so spoilers for
The Circle. So, yeah,
what's weird, and I'm going to spoil both the book and the movie, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, this movie, so immediately that's, you know, this girl's supposedly down her luck. We see her doing, like, a job in, like, a bland corporate environment, and she gets the magical call to, like, go interview at The Circle. We don't really get a sense of her life, though, before that, so it's most of the opening of the movie is her just being like, wow, look at this campus, and look at this free food, and look at all this stuff.
It's like Google, basically, right?
It's very much like a Google-Facebook hybrid. Yeah. That's what The Circle really is.
Yeah, like, and Blue Book from Ex Machina, basically.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But actually, yeah, that was actually something that could be conceivable. But yeah, this movie, it's basically like, if social media were to somehow lead to a complete, like, I don't know, totalitarian world, right? Because the company here is like, they worship sharing content, I guess, just in a similar way that Facebook does, but also erasing privacy in, like, ridiculous ways. Like, there's a point where the major innovation that they talk about in the movies are these tiny little video cameras that are, like, the size of, like, maybe a ping pong ball or something, but which are connected to satellites, Dave, and they just stream video in HD quality, and you could just stick it anywhere. You have all these cameras everywhere, and just see everything happening in the world, right? I don't even care that, you know, something like that wouldn't be possible with battery life or whatever. It's more like nobody questions anything. Like, this movie treats its characters like idiots. Even the main character, she doesn't really question why any of this is happening. And eventually they use this technology to start, like, let's have a little contest. Let's see if we can hunt down a criminal in 30 minutes using all the cameras around the world and all the phones.
It's like
the
God's Eye from Fast and Furious.
It is like the God's Eye, and turning it into, like, a feature or, like, a new product from this company. And they do it, and they find, somebody who is a criminal. Like, just seeing these social media users run out to find these people. But yeah, this leads to a point where they go and try to track down May's estranged ex-boyfriend, who's, like, living out in the woods somewhere. And
off the grid.
But they track him down to a cabin, right? They track him down. And these people, like, they chase him out of his house. And then it's a high-speed chase, Dave. And then they're following him with their cameras. And they're following him with drones. And a drone pops up in front of him. And he drives off a bridge. He's killed by social media, Dave.
As many millions of people have been.
So many millions.
He's killed by social media. Yeah.
And this is all being streamed live to millions of people. So it immediately shows you the downsides of this, too. And in the movie, May starts to try to get revenge in a certain way, although it seems like she's also on board with giving up her privacy. But in the book, it actually, May kind of goes evil and, like, just, like, completely buys into what the company is doing. as a movie, it just doesn't work. That was the thing. Like, James Ponsell as a director, I love because of the way he directs actors. I think he gets really natural performances from people. Nobody is good in this movie. Like, Emma Watson feels completely wooden. Even Tom Hanks, who we all love.
I heard someone say that this movie made them question whether Emma Watson was ever a good actor.
There is that. It's completely wooden. But also, none of the performances in this movie are good. Like, John Boyega is here, and he doesn't know what he's doing. It's a movie of terrible performances cut together in a way with zero motivation, with some of the most, like, ludicrous set pieces that I've ever seen. And, it doesn't understand technology. So it just feels like the entire movie is like, technology is bad. Okay, it's going to lead to the end of the world. And that's pretty much it. It doesn't actually say anything interesting. So I wrote up a piece about this on Engadget, and you can check that out. It's not good. And the guy from Boyhood is in it, so that's something.
The guy who's acting set the world on fire in Boyhood. That's incredibly mean. But
he's been in a couple movies, but also. He's not terrible.
I did not find him to be an impressive actor in Boyhood, but. Hey, speaking of Richard Linklater, though, have you purchased the Criterion Collection before Four? Series yet?
Yes, I have. I have not watched them yet, but I own them.
You have not watched them? Yeah, so I have not bought – that is one thing I'm going to buy this year. Is if I'm going to buy any hard copies of anything, it's going to be the Before trilogy on Criterion.
My life. That's all I need to know, right? I'll watch.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of curious as like how good the special features are on those movies.
Well, also, we've never had a so Before Sunrise, that was only available on DVD for a while, because that's a right. mid-90s movie.
It's true.
And I think there was an HD stream on iTunes and stuff, but this is like the first time you get a really nice, pristine version of that movie. So I think that alone makes it worthwhile.
I think the hugest bummer about that Criterion set, and it just kills me, Devendra, is it is the most ugly ass box art.
Possibly
of any Criterion box set is if you not the cover for the whole thing that actually looks very beautiful. It says the Before trilogy on the cover, but if you the individual movies like Before Sunrise, Before Sunset, Before Midnight, it looks like a ninth grader drew them. You know,
I think it looks better in person, maybe. I don't know what it is, but it didn't really bother me as much.
Specifically Before Midnight, it just that does not look at all like Ethan Hawke. You cannot look at the Before Midnight Criterion art and tell me that looks anything like Ethan Hawke.
Artistic license, Dave. Come on.
Dylan Schwan in the chat room right now says, the art is fucking atrocious. Ethan Hawke's face is mangled on every cover. It really is Ethan Hawke's face. Like, Julie Delpy looks okay. Ethan Hawke looks like a disaster on the box art.
I mean, that's a shame, but yeah, I'm going to stick the disc in and watch what's on that.
But, part of buying a Criterion is for the art. It's a collector's item too, right? So you kind of want the art to be awesome. Yeah.
I did. There's a Guillermo del Toro Criterion that has like Chronos and Devil's Backbone and Pan's Labyrinth in it in like a book form. I picked that up. That is nice packaging. Looks good.
Yeah. Honestly, I'm not joking. That art is partly keeping me from getting that Blu-ray. That plus the fairly high price point right now. I think
it's pretty high, but there was a 50% off Criterion sale. Next time it happens like every couple months.
Yeah. Domingo, I'm pretty sure I pointed it out to you the last time it happened, right?
No, that was a different sale.
I see.
That was something else.
All right.
But it was at that point at Amazon, it was only like 60 something, and now I think it's back up.
Someone in the chat room is asking, can any movie be in the Criterion Collection? Right? Like, what is the criteria?
It's $61 on Amazon right now, by the way.
Yeah, it's okay. The Criterion Collection, for this is from the website, is a continuing series of important classic and contemporary films on home video. Our editions often feature restored film transfers, commentary tracks, and other supplemental features that the company pioneered when it released its first Laserdiscs, Citizen Kane and King Kong, at the end of 1984. Ever since, Criterion has been working closely with filmmakers and scholars to ensure that each film is presented as its maker would want it seen and published in an edition that will deepen the viewer's understanding and appreciation of the art of cinema. And then when they say, like, how do they decide which films? They say, we aim to reflect the breadth of filmic expression. We try not to be restrictive or snobby about what kinds of films are appropriate. An auteur classic, a Hollywood blockbuster, or an independent B-horror film has to be taken on its own terms. All we ask that each film in the collection be an exemplary film of its kind. Of course, we can't just pick movies and put them out. The process of getting the rights to release a film can take years. Even if we want a film, we can't work on it unless the film's owner grants us rights. End quote. There is a huge variety of movies. You know, Michael Bay had a bunch of Criterion movies.
Armageddon.
On
the
Criterion.
Rock, too, right? Yeah. The Rock, I believe. That deserves a Criterion. Come on.
Yeah. I don't think The Rock ever got a Blu-ray Criterion, right?
Mm. I don't think so. But yeah, there were a bunch of early Criterions that never got transferred over.
Speaking of Blu-rays, we've been talking about we talked about Avatar a couple weeks ago, I don't think there is a The Rock Blu-ray on Criterion, which is
I'm looking. Yeah,
huge tragedy.
I mean, bigger tragedy that there's still no True Lies Blu-ray.
That's what I was going to say. We've been talking about Avatar. There is no True Lies Blu-ray. There's no Abyss Blu-ray.
Ugh.
Both things that I think we prefer James Cameron work on instead of
And I try to say this every time we bring up the Avatar sequel. Stuff, but that is partially why I'm just not into the Avatar movies. There's so many other things I want to see from him, but
well, you're saying True Lies is another thing. You'd rather he do the Blu-ray for True Lies instead of a new movie?
Yes, for sure.
You'd rather he go back instead of forward, you know?
I mean, I'd rather see him do different things. You know, like, look at what's possible now. Like, when he did The Abyss, like, I want to see him work in new mediums and new formats, you know? Like, and that's, I think, partially what's drawing him to Avatar. I just wish it was, like, another world or something, because I don't know if I'll care about any of this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hmm.
All right, man. Well, I think that's going to bring us to the end of this Slash Filmcast After Dark. Thanks for sticking around, Devendra. This has been fun.
It's been fun.